KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Reading.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The results found that parents and the general public do not like the idea that young children would have access to explicit content on school library shelves. And there's a lot of discussion today that any attempt to remove such books from school libraries is an effort at censorship, or that you're banning books. I think that's nonsense.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Jonathan Butcher, author of the recent book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. We go in-depth later on in today's program with Jonathan about what we really agree on. First, we're joined by John J. Miller. He is director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show.
Also author of a recent essay over at wordonfire.org, and it's titled, The News is Where You Look. And that's also the first line of this essay, John. What does that mean to you in practice? How does it shape news coverage at various outlets?
It's something a friend of mine said, a fellow journalist said recently, the news is where you look. And what I loved about that line is that it captures the most powerful force in media content. In other words, story selection, how you determine what is the news, what angle you take, how you determine what's not the news. And so much of it is where you look. It's where you look for news. It's what you think is news. And one of the implications, of course, is where are you not looking for news? Or are things happening there? But this idea, the news is where you look, I think captures this important factor in terms of what our media tells us. It has implications for media bias, all kinds of things. But I like that phrase, the news is where you look.
The where is important. The who is important, too. Why is it so important? Why does it matter who is doing this looking in journalism?
We all have our blind spots, of course, and we're prone to look in certain places and not in others, and maybe we can't even see into others. But it's a reminder that there's so much subjectivity in journalism in terms of determining what is the news and who's deciding? Well, it's editors, it's writers, and they don't walk into the office or get an email every morning saying, well, here's the news of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might, but someone's putting that together if they are. You know, the news is a series of independent judgments made by editors and producers and writers and more about what is the news. And so how do they come up with that? And it starts off with, you know, where are you looking? Let's imagine a reporter who covers Congress. And so you're on Capitol Hill and you can look for the press release that the member of the House puts out. And that's a perfectly good place to look for news. You can see the press release that a committee puts out. You can also attend the committee hearing in person and see what people say, hear what people say, observe the different actors. Maybe you wind up sitting down next to somebody who has a stake in the debate and you meet a source that way. So you're always looking around for the news, and it depends on what situations you put yourself in, how aggressive you are in terms of looking for the news. Do you just take the press release and repeat it? And sometimes you do because you can't make it to every meeting, but maybe you do go to the committee meeting. Maybe you see something that nobody else has seen because you were the one who was looking there at that moment.
This essay over at wordonfire.org suggests that curiosity is the most important quality in a journalist, which I was very happy to read because independently, I've been saying the same thing to people about our journalists here at Hillsdale for a number of years. How does curiosity lead to a better media?
I get this question all the time, Scott, of course, from students, also from parents, really from everybody. You know, what is the most important quality in a journalist? And there are lots of important qualities, but I always say curiosity. you need to be curious about the world. You want to be a person who wants to learn about the world we live in and then go tell true stories about it. That's what journalism really is. It's telling true stories about the world we live in. And so as you're looking around to figure out what is the news, it helps be a curious person, someone who asks questions and asks, you know, why is it that way? Why it used to be a different way? Why has it changed? Or why does this senator say this thing? You know, just ask questions all the time. And so you got to have a kind of curiosity wanting to ask those questions. And I say the second most important quality is humility, because you've got to recognize that you don't know everything. There are people who know a lot more than you do about really every topic, and you need to go find them when you're writing on it. So you need to be a person. You need curiosity, so you ask questions, and then humility, where you go and talk to people who know more than you do, and you go into it knowing they know more than you do, and you want to learn from them, hear what they have to say. You can question them. You don't have to believe everything they say, and probably you shouldn't. It helps to have some skepticism along with all this. But the idea of humility, which is that there are people who know a lot more than you do about what's going on behind closed doors, what's going on in a different country, why a business makes a certain decision, et cetera. Go find them. So curiosity and then humility. And finally, there's a sense of service, which is go tell a story that people want to hear.
John J. Miller is with us, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. His essay at wordonfire.org, "The News is Where You Look." You tell the story in the essay about seeing reporters collaborate on a narrative, a takeaway narrative after a debate, which makes me question, why would a journalist want to have the same story as everyone else? Why not something different?
Yeah, from rival news organizations. And the story is this. I was a number of years ago covering a Senate campaign for a national magazine. And I was writing a profile of one of the candidates, but during my travels, as I was following this candidate around, going to different events and having interviews and all that, there was a debate of the normal sort where the candidates get together and they have their little stump speeches. There's a moderator asking questions. There's some exchanges. I mean, you know, the format is a familiar thing. And in this instance, I was watching the debate, and I was in a room with fellow reporters, and we were just in the audience. We were just observers. We were not moderators. We were not participating in any way. But here we are. We're covering the debate, which is being broadcast on television, and we're in the room. And when the debate ended after, 60 minutes or whatever, the candidates left, and then the reporters from the different newspapers around the state, which had several media markets, I saw them all cluster together, and they did it right in front of me. They clustered together and talked about what is the news, what is the story here, and they had a little give and take, and they all settled on the same thing, which, because they're political reporters, it happened to be something the Republicans said that they regarded as controversial. And so this is what went out as the report in all these different newspapers in the state, because they gathered together and had this kind of hive mind moment. You know, this is herd mentality really on display. And I was astonished. And of course you see this all the time where they don't have to gather to do this kind of thing. Yeah. But here it was in front of me. They're actually doing it, and kind of linking arms to make sure that readers had the same story from all of them.
Media bias often comes from ideology, but it also can come from a place of ignorance, which is where the curiosity helps out. What are there types of stories or perspectives that tend to be overlooked as a result of that ignorance?
Yeah, there's a lot of ignorance, and ignorance is a tough word. There could also be a kind of innocence to it. I mean, I'm ignorant. Yeah. I'm ignorant of a lot of things, and this is the blind spots I mentioned. You know, if the news is where you look, you can see different things, you can observe them, but we all have blind spots. Like you're driving a car, there are blind spots, things you're not going to see. And in journalism, there are some common blind spots, I think. And one of the points I made in this piece is that religion is one of them. Mm-hmm. A lot of our so-called mainstream media organizations are just populated by people, entire newsrooms full of people who never walk inside a church. And so they don't think about faith. It just doesn't even occur to them. It is an actual blind spot. They don't think about these kinds of things. And so they don't cover them. It just isn't a part of their world. This is ignorance. And it might be willful. It might actually be, there might be some hostility involved. I'm sure all that is true, but I think a lot of it is just they don't even ever think about it. Mm-hmm. And we all have our blind spots. I have mine, but this is a common one. And so when we think about, you know, liberal media bias, a lot of it is ideological, people wanting to make certain kinds of points and having kinds of commitments that they want to exercise in their journalism, you know, often irresponsibly. Ignorance is a lot of it and can contribute to a kind of liberal media bias.
That's John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. We'll talk more about his essay in a moment. But first, an opportunity, a wonderful way to start the new year. There's a brand new Hillsdale College online course, The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin. It's part two of The History of Classical Music. Your professor, once again, Hyperion Knight. Look, classical music is beautiful. Hyperion Knight is talented and engaging. You might have heard him here on the program previously. You get to sit beside his piano as he plays excerpts from some of the greatest achievements of Western civilization and also tell us the stories of the great men who composed them. It's a rare joy and a great opportunity. This course picks up where the first course left off. Hyperion Knight has great energy, great charisma, and helps to open the enjoyment of classical music to absolutely everyone. Find it now at hillsdale.edu/new course, newcourse. It's a wonderful way to start the year. The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin, the new Hillsdale online course. Sign up today, hillsdale.edu/new course. Hillsdale.edu/new course. We continue with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, and also author of the recent essay over at wordonfire.org, The News is Where You Look. John, you pick up on this split in polling between journalists and regular Americans about whether stories should always strive to give every side equal coverage. And perhaps you've heard talk about this, like there's no need to give the opposite side of climate change. It's settled science. There's no need to have a response. Why would journalists in these cases be more likely to say that it's not a priority to get equal coverage?
Yeah, that's amazing. There's a poll that says most Americans would like their news stories to cover the different sides of a debate. And the same poll says most journalists disagree with this. They don't think that's important. And it's exactly what you say, which is that journalists have decided that they are experts. You know, this is the opposite of humility, mm-hmm. right? They've decided that they're the experts and they don't need to give equal space to untrue things, to, you know, climate skepticism. Climate change skepticism is a perfect example of that. They view this as just beyond question, or, you know, questioning the results of an election, for instance. You know, now we're increasingly seeing in the last 5 years, you know, someone makes a claim without evidence. Mm-hmm. We hear all, you know, this is now inserted into news stories all the time. So you get this sort of, you know, journalist wanting to have quote unquote expert judgment all the time, rather than just saying this is what the person said and then, you know, presenting what evidence there is, or maybe not if there isn't any, or whatever. But there's a kind of sense among a lot of journalists, I think, that they are the experts and they can now tell us the truth because they're going to protect us from what they view as maybe harmful ideas. And I will say at a certain level, you know, we do want a kind of expertise in journalism. I mean, we all want to rely on editors and reporters and producers who exercise judgment, mm-hmm. and good judgment on what is the news. And, you know, I can't keep track of everything that's happening in the world. And I try pretty hard as the director of a journalism program. I mean, I read a lot of news every day, but I can't keep track of everything that's going on in the world. And I depend on these people in the media to make good decisions about what I should know. And then they present it and, you know, and I read some things and not others. So you do need journalists with good judgment. What you don't need are these ones who they lack humility.
Yeah.
And they say, well, there's certain things we're not even going to discuss. Or if we do discuss it, we're going to make clear that, you know, we disagree with it and think it's a horrible idea.
Talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, his essay at wordonfire.org, "The News is Where You Look." We have seen one of the major newspapers in the country, the Washington Post, make some wholesale changes to the op-ed pages, but also among its reporting staff. Now, we did hear after 2016, too, media outlets trying to find and understand Trump supporters and change the tenor of coverage. That didn't really take hold. Have you seen a general shifted approach among the media?
No. I mean, there was, I think, after the 2024 election, there was another round of we need to do a better job of understanding the country. In other words, you know, a kind of honest liberal saying we don't understand what's going on out there. And you saw this after 2016 and some you know, gestures towards doing a better job of covering the rest of the country. And you know, a few efforts made in that direction, but then quickly abandoned because, you know, Trump is awful or whatever. And I think there were some moments like that post 2024 as well. But I think they've essentially reverted to form. The Washington Post, though, is an interesting case, which you mentioned, which is changing its editorial perspective, which for years has been just conventional liberalism. Basically a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party, in all the ways you would expect a liberal newspaper to be. It was just that. It was really the sort of conventional wisdom of liberal Washington was the Washington Post stance. Well, Jeff Bezos is the owner. He's not, you know, he didn't buy it last year. He's owned it for a number of years, but he finally is starting to exercise some of his control over the Washington Post and saying we need to change this and make the page a little more interesting. And we're going to commit ourselves to you know, the idea of freedom in every sense. And so they're reorienting the page a little bit. There have been some interesting staff changes there. Mm-hmm. We're just starting to see some of the changes. It'll be interesting to see how this shakes out in the months ahead. There'll be some controversies about and hirings and et cetera. But, you know, the first signal of this was last fall when Bezos essentially spiked the Washington Post's endorsement of Kamala Harris. And he said, we're not going to endorse for president. And this caused a kind of, I don't know, staff revolt is too big of a term, but there's a lot of discomfort with that in the newsroom because they all wanted to endorse Kamala Harris. And Bezos was like, look, you know, when we endorse Kamala Harris, it confuses a lot of readers who think our news coverage is one-sided, even though very often it is. but he says it creates confusion among readers. And I think he's right about that. At any rate, they're making a lot of changes there. And I'm interested to see what happens next. I think it's going to be a better opinion section in the Washington Post.
John J. Miller leads the journalism program here at Hillsdale College, and the program emphasizes learning by doing. And journalism here at Hillsdale is a minor and not a major. So why is that, and how do students who are interested in journalism grow through the hands-on work they do here?
We're a liberal arts college. Small L liberal arts college, which means we think our students should major in traditional academic disciplines, major in history, in biology, in English, whatever. Focus your studies there. We also do journalism, and we do have some courses on journalism. It is a minor, and you can get a minor in journalism here. But the biggest emphasis we have within this journalism program is the hands-on learning, the fact that we have a campus newspaper, that we have a campus radio station, which, Scott, you and I are sitting in a studio at the campus radio station right now. And the way you learn journalism is by doing it. I can teach students some things in a classroom. I can tell them stuff, but ultimately you've got to go report stories, write articles, lay them out on a page, do all the production. It's like shooting free throws. I can describe to you how to shoot a free throw. You know, bend your knees and, you know, put your toes on the line and, you know, don't cross the line. You can say a lot of things about that, and that's even valuable information, but ultimately you got to go shoot a bunch of free throws. And if you shoot them, you'll get pretty good at them, or at least you have a chance of getting pretty good at them. So in journalism here, we have students work on the campus newspaper. They put out a paper every week. It's a student-run publication. We have faculty advisors. We try and train them, but they're putting out a newspaper every week. And we have a radio station, which is a spoken word format. We have hours and hours of student programming every day. And it's like the applied art of rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. You want to learn how to communicate. Well, how about sitting in front of a microphone and sounding good for 10 minutes and having a monologue that is actually interesting? You know, how do you do that? It's harder than it sounds. And, you know, the great ones make it sound easy, but it takes practice. It takes discernment. And that's what we teach. And you learn it by doing it.
We have graduates who are entering the world of journalism. Where have they ended up over the years? And what kind of perspectives, what kind of work have they been able to accomplish in mainstream media outlets, faith-based media outlets, or elsewhere?
We have amazing alumni in journalism, and they are everywhere. They are in the White House press pool today. We have several on the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They are at National Review, the Detroit News, the Tennessean, they are all over the place, these Hillsdale alumni, and they have different kinds of interests, these different students. They go into, some go into news, some go into opinion. There is a faith element, as you mentioned. We have alumni at First Things, which mm-hmm. is a journal of religion and public life. We have alumni at the Catholic News Agency, which is a kind of wire service that provides Catholic news, and they go into all these different kinds of places. And so a lot of diversity. You know, Hillsdale has a reputation of being a conservative school, and a lot of our students are in fact conservative, but there are a lot of flavors of that, and they come in different forms and different levels of interest in things like politics and religion, and they go into all kinds of places, and they are flourishing. And one of the things I love to say to students, and one of the things I love to say is if you're interested in a career in journalism or in the media, being a professional, if you do the minor here at Hillsdale College, you will get a job, and you'll have a shot at having a great career in that field.
John J. Miller is the director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College. You can read his essay at wordonfire.org titled "The News is Where You Look." You also now can find him writing in the Wall Street Journal in Free Expression and newsletter-focused opinion brand. You can find it at wsj.com. John, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Jonathan Butcher joins us. He's the author of The Polarization Myth. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Classical music is one of the greatest achievements of Western civilization. It took 2,000 years, and the work of the greatest philosophical, scientific, political, and religious minds to properly tune the piano and make great music possible. But classical music can be intimidating. In Hillsdale College's new, free, online course, The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin, you'll learn how to appreciate humanity's greatest musical accomplishments. In The History of Classical Music, concert pianist and Hillsdale College Distinguished Fellow Hyperion Knight explains how music has developed and what distinguishes the greatest musical achievements of Western civilization. To enroll today and secure your spot in this completely free online course, visit hillsdale.edu/network. That's hillsdale.edu/network.
Great books, great people, great ideas. Learning about these things is critical to being a well-educated human being, and we can help with the Hillsdale Dialogues. Each week, Hillsdale College President Larry Arn joins radio veteran Hugh Hewitt to discuss topics of enduring relevance. And from time to time, they also talk about current events, but always with an eye toward more fundamental truths. And they want you to tune in to a conversation like no other. The Hillsdale Dialogues are posted every Monday on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. Or listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you find your audio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. We're joined by Jonathan Butcher. He's the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation, also the author of a new book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
We've heard a lot these past few months, 12 months maybe, about 80-20 issues, especially for...
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
Tools like price history, dealer scorecards, and even a free VIN check so you can shop with confidence. Don't just buy a car, buy it smarter. Visit iccars.com today or download the app and find the right car at the right price. That's iseecars.com. Looking for expert insights on the cars that really matter? Then check out Carl Brower Cars on YouTube. Carl Brower has spent decades testing and analyzing vehicles from every brand at every price point. You'll find detailed reviews, the latest car news, and deep dives into what's hot and what's not in the automotive world. Whether you're shopping for your next car or just love staying on top of what's happening in the industry, Carl Brower Cars gives you straight talk, real analysis, and no fluff. Don't just read about cars. See them in action. Subscribe now to Carl Brower Cars on YouTube and join a growing community of drivers and enthusiasts who want the truth about today's vehicles. That's K-A-R-L-B-R-A-U-E-R Cars on YouTube.
Scholarships limited by race, segregated graduation ceremonies in dorms, professors labeling students as oppressors based on skin color, gender, or religion. This is DEI in action. Divisive, toxic, and un-American. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. dreamed of a nation where his children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. DEI turns that dream upside down. But there's hope. DEI is being rolled back. Through civil rights enforcement, federal funding cuts, and growing cultural resistance to its harm in schools, workplaces, and communities. America is strongest when united, not divided. Our universities should lead the way in bringing people together, not driving them apart. Visit campusreform.org to learn more about the fight against DEI on college campuses. Restoring Truth, Correcting Bias in Education, One Story at a Time. A series brought to you by the Leadership Institute and Radio America.
And welcome back to the Paul Parent Garden Club. Our phone number here is 339-645-0201. Again, 339-645-0201. Now, if you missed part of the show or you want to hear an old one, go to anywhere you download your podcasts, whether it be Apple or Spotify. Search the Paul Parent Garden Club, and you'll be able to find them. They're split by the hour, so a couple shows come out each week, Monday afternoon into the evening, and you'll be able to just hear what we discussed all the way back for a little over a year now with the Radio America. You can also, we have a bunch of other episodes that I have stored away that we'll be able to once we fix some of the new website and the emails and everything. Like I promised last week, one of my big things was I want to get the website back up and running to a little bit stronger and the newsletters out to you guys. So a lot of that stuff, I have some old shows saved up and we'll be able to get those eventually as well. Now, we've been talking about some perennials, right? And we talked about rosemary, an herb. We might as well talk about another herb that might be a good one to have, and that is the peppermint, right? That's a hardy perennial herb. And it can grow in New England, it can grow all over. But again, I'm going to start to tell you a little bit of details behind it. Now, there are well over 25 varieties of mint out there. But peppermint and spearmint are the most popular of all. They've been in the gardens for a long, long time. Now, spearmint, again, is a native to the Mediterranean. And it was introduced to the world by the Romans. Mint was found in Egyptian tombs that were dating back to 1000 BC. And in Japan, they've been growing many different varieties for at least 2000 years. So mint's been around. Mint's been a long time coming. Now, mint was brought to America by the settlers, really as an additive to clean their homes and to help make them smell good, as well as cooking. It wasn't just cooking. There were multiple reasons. Another thing that was done with it, monks, when they traveled to new lands, they would actually spread the word of the Lord, and mint was planted around their new missions to use as a scent for their bath water and cooking. And finally, some Greek mythology for you. Said that two strangers were walking through the countryside and were being ignored by all. An elderly couple took pity on the tired-looking travelers and invited them into their home for a good meal. They cleaned their dining table with mint leaves to freshen the table and cooked them a meal. The couple was rewarded by the strangers as their home was turned into a beautiful temple. The strangers were the gods Hermes and Zeus. From that day on, mint became the hospitality plant. Pretty cool little story, right? So, mint. It's grown from seed or by dividing established plants to make new ones. It's kind of a theme we've gone through a little bit today of dividing. I'm not going to lie, it was accidental. So, the seed-grown plants do not have the same types of quality, flavor as the same varieties grown from division. So division of your plants are more flavorable. That being said, it's not like there's no flavor to them if you've grown by seed. But it is one that they're usually better the second growing season for flavor if you plant them by seed, right? So once it's kind of died back in the fall, the plant has gone dormant, that's when you can divide these plants. But you do that in the fall months so that the next season it can grow through. Now, mint grows best in a garden with a little bit of shade. It doesn't need full sun, but it doesn't need full shade either. Now, the reason behind having some of that shade is to help it so that it's not drying out throughout the summer months, especially during the times when you can't water because of water bans. Mint tends to dry out a little bit quicker than some of the others. So if you can actually water throughout the summer, you think it can go in a sunny area, but a little bit of shade will help take that curse off of it so you're not watering as often. And the plant doesn't get as dry. New England, the northern part of the country where we have the cool winters, it would be okay in full sun because of the cooler climates. But I've been noticing the summers have been getting a little bit warmer and more heat happening. So maybe adding that shade would be beneficial for you. As far as soil, we want that soil to be as rich as possible, so adding anything to that soil is going to be beneficial to it. This isn't one that wants to be a sandy soil or a well-drained, heavy-drained soil. It wants to have those extra nutrients in it. So it's really kind of the opposite way of the rosemary, hence why I was saying maybe plant the rosemary in a different spot than your other herbs. You want to add something, cow manure, some sort of compost is definitely beneficial in the garden. Now, mint is something that returns every year, so it is a perennial. And, you know, it is something that can be, I'm not going to lie, become invasive. It can just go crazy. It's very aggressive. So if you're not paying attention to it, it can just take over a full area. So that's why a lot of people will divide it and pull it back. But just something to be thinking about. It might be one that you plant in a container as well, because they can be in like a 12-inch, 18-inch container and do well versus being in the garden and just kind of taking over. When they take over and they become aggressive, they lose a lot of the flavor. They lose a lot of everything that you're looking for. But it is something that can be done either way. Okay. Now, fertilization during the season, we can use the garden fertilizer from Natural Alternative. We can also use the protolizer to really give it a nice kick in the spring and then use it once a month. But the big, big thing when it comes to peppermint is water. Water is the most important thing in this plant. I mentioned earlier that it can dry out very quickly. And so when you're planting, you want to be able to hold that water a little bit more. We want to make sure it has a little bit of shade during those sunny, hot days so it doesn't dry out as quickly. Obviously, the size of the plant will determine the water will decide determine the size of the plant, but the size of the plant will then determine the quality of the flavor in the foliage. The plant really, you know, it does want to expand a bit, but we don't want it to get too big in your garden. Now, they come in a variety of a foliage, but leaves are mostly oval in shape with that blunt tip on the end. They'll grow about 1 to 2 inches long and about 1 inch wide. So complete opposite of the rosemary. They're a bigger leaf to it. Some have shiny leaves, while others have dull and almost just non-existent looks to them, right? Each plant is unique and really has its own smell. A lot of people use them in essential oils, right? The mint plants have white, lavender to lilac pink flower clusters. They're on the tip of the branches, mid to late summer. When the mint is in flower in your garden, expect to see, you know, more butterflies and bees of all types in the garden. It's really nice to add something like this to have in the home. Now, winter mint water. Excuse me. I'm going all over the place. I apologize. But watering mint is usually best to be done in the morning because it's preventing the disease problems that come along. It's also a big way to allow it to not dry out during the day in the hot part of the day, right? Because we want water in it. Now, I've mentioned this, I don't know how many times, I've lost count. But when we're watering, one of the main reasons we're watering in the morning has nothing to do with you know, watering bans or being outside of it, has everything to do with how beneficial it is for the plant. It's beneficial for the plant because think about this. If the hottest part of the day, a lot of people will say, is between 10 and 2, 10 and 4. If you were to water at, let's say, 6 p.m., 7 p.m. at night, and you water every night at that time, 24 hours from 6 p.m. is obviously 6 p.m., but the hottest part of the day is about 16 hours in. And it goes for, you know, let's call it 6-8 hours. And so the hottest part of the day is the part of the day where the plant doesn't have as much moisture. It's starting to dry out. Depending upon the heat, the wind, everything, it could dry out quickly. Whereas if you water in the morning, say you water at 6, 7, 8 a.m., hottest part of the day between 10 and 2, 10 and 4, is just at the beginning of the plant's cycle of when you've watered it. So the water is in the plant. It's holding the moisture in. It won't dry out as quickly. It will obviously still dry out because the sun, the weather is going to do that. But by doing it in the morning, it's going to help hold the moisture in the plant. Okay. It also helps prevent, you know, disease problems because it has the day to dry out. Whereas if you water at night, it can, you know, any of those diseases could be in the area. There could be, you know, moisture that is causing this disease to happen. Hence why it would happen overnight. It can't dry out. Whereas during the day, it allows that to happen. This is, also, one, keep away from the automatic watering system, your sprinkler systems. It's actually, you know, sprinkler systems are great for a lawn to keep the lawn going. But for your perennial bed shrubs, all the different planting beds, not as great. You might be better off using some soaker hoses in those areas and use the sprinklers for the lawn because the lawn needs to be sprayed over that way. So, what else is going on with the mint here? I went off on the watering tangent, but I do find that it is super important. Now, you can actually every few years divide this plant because it's going to start going into your other, you know, plants in the area. So you could plant it in an herb garden, but it might make sense to use like a bamboo barrier in between or something so the roots can't push through into the plants, other plants within it, because it is aggressive and will take over. But it is something you can dig up, give to some others as well. And we got to take a break here. We'll come back, wrap the show up, put a nice little bow on it, so stay tuned. We'll be back in a few.
This is your Tech It Out Minute, brought to you by Norton.
With so many of us streaming, surfing, and working online, we've become way more dependent on our Wi-Fi. And if you're sick of spotty and laggy Wi-Fi in your home, then you may need an upgrade. Tech expert Amber Mack has a suggestion.
My pick is the TP-Link Archer DE400 Wi-Fi 7 router. So this router can help to ensure that you're getting fast and secure Wi-Fi for better internet connectivity. There's nothing worse than a kid at home who's trying to do their homework and the Wi-Fi flakes out. One of the things I also love about this is that there's an app called the Tether app, and this makes managing not just your home network easy, but it also has parental control. So that means I'm able to set screen time access for individual devices in the home. So a really great all-in-one solution.
Find out more at tp-link.com.
That was your Tech It Out Minute, brought to you by Norton.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
What were the biggest stories of the year?
Has Donald Trump set up an economic powerhouse for the coming year? We'll answer these questions and more on Liberty Nation Radio.
Author, columnist, managing editor of LibertyNation.com, podcast host and conservative policy advocate.
We dismiss history at our peril.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
I know that hiring can be challenging. You sort through tons of resumes and you get too many so-so applicants. You're just waiting for someone to match your role perfectly. Well, now, there's a place where you can meet them fast. ZipRecruiter.
Need to hire right away. Start your search for strong candidates. The right fit awaits. Build your team.
Just head to ZipRecruiter.com/free right now to try it for free. And you're on your way to meeting your match. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So try it now. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/free.
Meet your match on ZipRecruiter. Try it free.
Reach your destination, not the ditch, with Issy Tire Socks, the amazing new solution to keep you from slipping and sliding in snow and ice. And anyone can install them in minutes for emergency traction and quick trips in the winter. Issy is the global leader in tire socks, and it's no wonder why. Issy is an essential part of your winter emergency kit, whether you drive a car, SUV, or light truck. Give the gift of grip for safer driving. Available at Amazon, Walmart, and other major retailers. Don't get stuck. Get Issy, I-S-S-E, really, Issy.com.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Or maybe you just want the truth about the latest models before you head to the dealership. Then you need Car Coach Reports. Lauren Fix will give you the unfiltered truth. You'll get an insider's perspective on a wide range of automotive topics in a fun, fast segment with a bit of attitude. Car Coach Reports gives you the inside track. Don't get lost in the hype. Get the facts you can trust in an easy-to-digest segment. When it comes to buying a car, she covers it all. Politics, new cars, used cars, the best practices when you're getting your car, and everything you should know about maintaining your car. Plus, what's coming up next in the automotive market and how to prepare yourself. Subscribe now to Car Coach Reports on YouTube and join thousands of drivers who rely on Lauren for honest expert advice. And if you're looking for more car reviews, Lauren also has Car Smarts on YouTube.
This season, give yourself the gift of peace of mind with Verizon Family Plus. Always know where your loved ones are. With location monitoring and alerts, you can track them using GPS or approximate network location. With parental controls, you can set safe screen time limits and easily block specific apps and websites. And we provide driving insights with post-drive reports for every family member and roadside assistance when you need it most. Get all the essential features of Family Plus for just $10 a month when you add it as a perk on your My Plan. Visit Verizon.com/family today.
60 Seconds of Service.
This 60 Seconds of Service is presented by T-Mobile. Those who serve, save with T-Mobile. Military families get exclusive savings with T-Mobile, the best mobile network in the U.S., according to Ookla Speed Test. So you can stay connected wherever you are. Visit T-Mobile.com/military-savings to learn more. Dan Jakubczyk, a Vietnam-era veteran, has spent more than a decade and a half volunteering at the Milwaukee VA alongside his wife. Week after week, he visits patients, delivering conversation, comfort, and a reassuring presence to veterans who may feel isolated or overwhelmed. His commitment to quiet, dependable service recently earned him a National Volunteer Award, recognizing not just the hours he has given, but the quality of compassion behind them. He considers it a privilege to support hospitalized veterans, saying it helps him honor those he served with decades ago. Prevagen is the number one pharmacist-recommended memory support brand. You can find Prevagen in the vitamin aisle in stores everywhere.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
What were the biggest stories of the year? Has Donald Trump set up an economic powerhouse for the coming year? We'll answer these questions and more on Liberty Nation Radio.
Author, columnist, managing editor of LibertyNation.com, podcast host and conservative policy advocate.
We dismiss history at our peril.
Liberty Nation with Mark Angelides.
Welcome back to the Paul Parent Garden Club. Our phone number here is 339-645-0201, and I'd love to hear from you. If you don't call, you can also text that phone number, and we can get your question on air that way. Now, talking a little bit about mint and how aggressive it is, I mentioned using bamboo barrier. Well, there is a quick, easy way to do it, and it's going to cost a lot less, and you might not be able to find the bamboo barrier. What you can actually do is take a 5-gallon bucket and you cut off the bottom of it, and you can actually dig the hole into the garden and place that bucket in it. Okay? You're going to leave about 3 inches of the bucket sticking up out of the soil, and then you're going to fill that bucket with soil. Basically, use the soil you dug up and put it in there. We're not looking to add a fancy soil to it. But what this is going to do, it's very important to leave that 3-inch gap there, It's going to keep it contained in that area. It's not going to go through the plastic to send out new plants around it. It's going to keep it contained. That way, the runners will stop spreading and it won't be as aggressive. And then you can just use the plant that's there. And it's going to be easier than finding some bamboo barrier, right? But this is one of the easier ways to contain it. Now, obviously, we've talked about peppermint here. Spearmint is another one out there. But there are so many flavors of mint out there now. There's pineapple, apple, chocolate. There's some orange themed. I mean, it is all over the place. And hey, when Kentucky Derby comes around, you can make a mint julep out of it. Just saying. Maybe it's an idea. It's too early to be thinking about those thoughts. Anyways. That's really wrapping it up about the mint, the peppermint, but just some ideas of some different plants to have out in the garden, and whether it be herbs or perennials, all of these are great additives for you to your garden. Now, the new year, we're already starting to think spring. We've been talking about it. I'd have to mention. This would be a good time to reach out to Natural Alternative to get some information about what you can do this spring. Now, depending upon what you are, where you are within the country, they have a cool season grass, and then they have cool season lawn program and a warm season fertilizer program. So these are ones that you can actually start to think about now. Maybe it's contacting them, going to their website at natural-alternative.com, and you choose what's right for you. They have always been and will always be one of those companies that when you call, you talk to a human. You're not hitting 17 different numbers to find somebody. You're actually talking to somebody. Funny story, about a year and a half ago, I couldn't find the number that I needed to get a hold of Karen, right? And I called the 800 number. And who picks up? Karen. And I was like, hey, it's Patrick. She's like, oh, hey. She thought I was one of the truck drivers for the company because her and I always go over text her through the cell phone. It was just one of the funnier things. I was like, wow, you do actually pick up the phone. So they're there to help you out. But this would be the time to start thinking about the lawn program that you're going to be doing this upcoming year. And they have their five-step program, their five applications, A1, A2, A3, A4, and A5. Awesome program. You can buy it in a bundle or you can buy it individual. But this would be something to be thinking about for this upcoming spring. How are you going to get started and can you have it right away? And you should want to have it early enough. So thinking spring is going to be able to get you some of those items and say, hey, maybe you don't need it for another month, but you want some information. They're there to help you out. You can always email them as well. Just click on their contact on their website. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. I appreciate everybody for listening. There's a number of new listeners out there, so welcome. We appreciate everybody. We want everybody to feel welcome in the Garden Club. Definitely call us with any questions. That phone number, 339-645-0201. You can also email us. Our email address is paulpgardenclub@gmail.com. Love to hear from you guys, put you on here so we can have some good discussions going forward. That's going to do it. Till next week, be good to each other. Get out there, actually in there, plant something. We'll talk at you guys next week. Have a great one. We'll see you.
I know that hiring can be challenging. You sort through tons of resumes and you get too many so-so applicants. You're just waiting for someone to match your role perfectly. Well, now, there's a place where you can meet them fast. ZipRecruiter.
Need to hire right away. Start your search for strong candidates. The right fit awaits. Build your team.
Just
Just head to ZipRecruiter.com/free right now to try it for free. And you're on your way to meeting your match. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So try it now. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/free.
Meet your match on ZipRecruiter. Try it free.
News this hour from Town Hall. I'm Ron Taylor. The U.S. has launched another round of retaliatory strikes against the Islamic State in Syria following last month's ambush that killed 2 U.S. soldiers and 1 American civilian interpreter in the country.
Large-scale strikes conducted by the U.S. alongside partner forces occurred around 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time, according to the U.S. Central Command. The strikes hit multiple Islamic State targets across Syria. Saturday strikes are part of a broader operation that is part of President Donald Trump's response to the deadly ISIS attacks that killed Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard, and Ayad Mansour Sakat, the civilian interpreter, in Palmyra last month. The Pentagon said Saturday strikes were carried out alongside partner forces without specifying which forces had taken part. Bernie Bennett, Washington.
Greenland's party leaders are saying no to President Trump.
In a statement Friday night, Greenland Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen and 4 party leaders said, "We don't want to be Americans. We don't want to be Danes. We want to be Greenlanders." President Donald Trump once again said on Friday that he'd like to make a deal to acquire Greenland, a semi-autonomous region that's part of NATO ally Denmark. And he said,
I would like to make a deal, you know, the easy way, but if we don't do it the easy way, we're going to do it the hard way.
Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen has said that an American takeover of Greenland would mark the end of NATO. I'm Donna Warder.
The police chief in Portland, Oregon, says the 2 suspects shot by ICE officers this week appear to have been in a gang-related shooting last summer, that according to Portland, Oregon Police Chief Bob Day. Activists say the death toll in the nationwide protest challenging Iran's theocracy has reached at least 116 people killed. The U.S.-based Human Rights News Agency gave the new figure, saying arrests had also reached around the figure of 2,600 people that had been arrested in the incidents. You'll find news and analysis at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor.
In today's fast-paced world, professionals face endless projects, deadlines, competition. To thrive, you need mental clarity, sharp focus, and reliable memory. That's why the same company that brings you Relief Factor created ThinkFactor. ThinkFactor is designed to help you think clearer and perform better daily. It's a powerful blend of nutrients that supercharges your memory and sharpens your focus. You can stay on top of your work and outshine the competition. After a couple of weeks of taking ThinkFactor, I noticed a dramatic difference in my clarity, my focus, even my memory. And you know what? But the longer you take ThinkFactor, the better the results are. If you've ever felt mentally foggy or struggled to keep up with everything on your plate, well, ThinkFactor can help you reclaim your cognitive edge and thrive in your life. Call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF, or visit ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com, to order ThinkFactor. Call 800-4-RELIEF or visit ReliefFactor.com. Your first bottle, just $19.95. ThinkFactor. Think clearer, perform better daily.
The protests in Iran have continued despite threats from the government to crack down. Middle East expert Dr. Michael Oren believes leadership in Tehran is in deep trouble.
They may succeed in suppressing this revolt for a week or two, but the fact of the matter is the longevity of this regime is now very much in question. They have been humiliated by Israel, humiliated by the United States. They have no electricity. They have no water. Their currency, the rial, has lost 60% of its worth. Women are no longer wearing head coverings in the street. Its days are numbered.
Online videos show demonstrators protesting Friday night, even after authorities shut down the internet and cut phone lines. Bob Weir, guitarist, singer, and founding member of the Grateful Dead, has died. Weir's death was announced Saturday by a statement on his Instagram page saying he had been in cancer but succumbed to underlying lung issues. Weir joined the Grateful Dead in 1965. Bob Weir was 78. News at townhall.com. President Trump met Friday with U.S. oil company executives about doing business in Venezuela. More from White House correspondent Greg Clugston.
Less than a week after the U.S. military ousted Venezuela's leader, the president met with top oil executives at the White House, urging them to invest in that South American country.
The plan is for them to spend at least $100 billion to rebuild the capacity and the infrastructure necessary.
Given the current political uncertainty in Venezuela and its history of state asset seizures, the president promised the oil companies they will have total safety. Greg Clugston, Washington.
The president has issued a new executive order to protect Venezuelan oil revenue from judicial proceedings. The order, made public earlier today, aims to support U.S. efforts to stabilize Venezuela economically and politically. Top oil executives have warned that Venezuela's instability makes it unattractive for private investment. More on these stories at townhall.com.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Redding.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The results found that parents and the general public do not like the idea that young children would have access to explicit content on school library shelves. And there's a lot of discussion today that any attempt to remove such books from school libraries is an effort at censorship, or that you're banning books. I think that's nonsense.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Jonathan Butcher, author of the recent book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. We go in-depth later on in today's program with Jonathan about what we really agree on. First, we're joined by John J. Miller. He is director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show.
Also author of a recent essay over at wordonfire.org, and it's titled, The News is Where You Look. And that's also the first line of this essay, John. What does that mean to you in practice? How does it shape news coverage at various outlets?
It's something a friend of mine said, a fellow journalist said recently, the news is where you look. And what I loved about that line is that it captures the most powerful force in media content. In other words, story selection, how you determine what is the news, what angle you take, how you determine what's not the news. And so much of it is where you look. It's where you look for news. It's what you think is news. And one of the implications, of course, is where are you not looking for news, or are things happening there? But this idea of the news is where you look, I think, captures this important factor in terms of what our media tells us. It has implications for media bias, all kinds of things. But I like that phrase, the news is where you look.
The where is important. The who is important, too. Why is it so important? Why does it matter who is doing this looking in journalism?
We all have our blind spots, of course, and we're prone to look in certain places and not in others. And maybe we can't even see into others. But it's a reminder that there's so much subjectivity in journalism in terms of determining what is the news and who's deciding? Well, it's editors. It's writers. And they don't walk into the office or get an email every morning saying, well, here's the news of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might, but someone's putting that together if they are. You know, the news is a series of independent judgments made by editors and producers and writers and more about what is the news. And so how do they come up with that? And it starts off with, you know, where are you looking? Let's imagine a reporter who covers Congress. And so you're on Capitol Hill and you can look for the press release that the member of the House puts out. And that's a perfectly good place to look for news. You can see the press release that a committee puts out. You can also attend the committee hearing in person and see what people say, hear what people say, observe the different actors, maybe Maybe you wind up sitting down next to somebody who has a stake in the debate and you meet a source that way. So you're always looking around for the news, and it depends on what situations you put yourself in, how aggressive you are in terms of looking for the news. Do you just take the press release and repeat it? And sometimes you do because you can't make it to every meeting, but maybe you do go to the committee meeting. Maybe you see something that nobody else has seen because you were the one who was looking there at that moment.
This essay over at wordonfire.org suggests that curiosity is the most important quality in a journalist, which I was very happy to read because independently, I've been saying the same thing to people about our journalists here at Hillsdale for a number of years. How does curiosity lead to a better media?
I get this question all the time, Scott, of course, from students, also from parents, really from everybody. You know, what is the most important quality in a journalist? And there are lots of important qualities, but I always say curiosity. You need to be curious about the world. You want to be a person who wants to learn about the world we live in and then go tell true stories about it. That's what journalism really is. It's telling true stories about the world we live in. And so as you're looking around to figure out what is the news, it helps be a curious person, someone who asks questions and asks, you know, why is it that way? How, you know, why it used to be a different way? Why has it changed? Or why does this senator say this thing, you know, just ask questions all the time. And so you gotta have a kind of curiosity wanting to ask those questions. And I say the second most important quality is humility because you've got to recognize that you don't know everything. There are people who know a lot more than you do about really every topic, and you need to go find them when you're writing on it. So you need to be a person. You need curiosity, so you ask questions, and then humility, where you go and talk to people who know more than you do, and you go into it knowing they know more than you do, and you want to learn from them, hear what they have to say. You can question them. You don't have to believe everything they say, and probably you shouldn't. It helps to have some skepticism along with all this. But the idea of humility, which is that there are people who know a lot more than you do about what's going on behind closed doors, what's going on in a different country, why a business makes a certain decision, et cetera. Go find them. So curiosity and then humility. And finally, there's a sense of service, which is go tell a story that people want to hear.
John J. Miller is with us, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. His essay at wordonfire.org, "The News is Where You Look." You tell the story in the essay about seeing reporters collaborate on a narrative, a takeaway narrative after a debate, which makes me question, why would a journalist want to have the same story as everyone else? Why not something different?
Yeah, from rival news organizations. Yeah. And the story is this. I was a number of years ago covering a Senate campaign for a national magazine. And I was writing a profile of one of the candidates, but during my travels, as I was following this candidate around, going to different events and having interviews and all that, there was a debate of the normal sort where the candidates get together and they have their little stump speeches. There's a moderator asking questions. There's some exchanges. I mean, you know, the format is a familiar thing. And in this instance, I was watching the debate, and I was in a room with fellow reporters, and we were just in the audience. We were just observers. We were not moderators. We were not participating in any way. But here we are. We're covering the debate, which is being broadcast on television, and we're in the room. And when the debate ended after, you know, 60 minutes or whatever, the candidates left, and then the reporters from the different newspapers around the state, which had several media markets, I saw them all cluster together, and they did it right in front of me. They clustered together and talked about what is the news, what is the story here, and they had a little give and take, and they all settled on the same thing, which, because they're political reporters, it happened to be something the Republicans said that they regarded as controversial. And so this is what went out as the report in all these different newspapers in the state, because they gathered together and had this kind of hive mind moment. You know, this herd mentality really on display. And I was astonished. And of course, you see this all the time where actually, you know, they don't have to gather to do this kind of thing. Yeah. But here it was in front of me. They're actually doing it and kind of linking arms to make sure that, you know, readers had the same story from all of them.
Media bias often comes from ideology, but it also can come from a place of ignorance, which is where the curiosity helps out. What kind, are there types of stories or perspectives that tend to be overlooked as a result of that ignorance?
Yeah, there's a lot of ignorance, and ignorance is a tough word. There could also be a kind of innocence to it. I mean, ignorant. Yeah. I'm ignorant of a lot of things. And this is the blind spots I mentioned. You know, if the news is where you look, you can see different things, you can observe them. But, you know, we all have blind spots. Like you're driving a car, there are blind spots, things you're not going to see. And in journalism, there are some common blind spots, I think. And one of the points I made in this piece is that religion is one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of our so-called mainstream media organizations are just populated by people, entire newsrooms full of people who never walk inside a church. And so they don't think about faith. It just doesn't even occur to them. It is an actual blind spot. They don't think about these kinds of things. And so they don't cover them. It just isn't a part of their world. This is ignorance. And it might be willful. It might actually be, there might be some hostility involved. I'm sure all that is true. But I think a lot of it is just they don't even ever think about it. Mm-hmm. And we all have our blind spots. I have mine. But this is a common one. And so when we think about, you know, liberal media bias, a lot of it is ideological. People wanting to make certain kinds of points and having kinds of commitments that they want to exercise in their journalism, you know, often irresponsibly. Ignorance is a lot of it and can contribute to a kind of liberal media bias.
That's John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. We'll talk more about his essay in a moment. But first, an opportunity, a wonderful way to start the new year. There's a brand new Hillsdale College online course, The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin. It's part two of The History of Classical Music. Your professor, once again, Hyperion Knight. Look, classical music is beautiful. Hyperion Knight is talented and engaging. You might have heard him here on the program previously. You get to sit beside his piano as he plays excerpts from some of the greatest achievements of Western civilization and also tell us the stories of the great men who composed them. It's a rare joy and a great opportunity. This course picks up where the first course left off. Hyperion Knight has great energy, great charisma, and helps to open the enjoyment of classical music to absolutely everyone. Find it now at hillsdale.edu/new course. NEWCOURSE. It's a wonderful way to start the year. The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin, the new Hillsdale online course. Sign up today. hillsdale.edu/new course. hillsdale.edu/new course. We continue with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, and also author of the recent essay over at wordonfire.org, The News is Where You Look. John, you pick up on this split in polling between journalists and regular Americans about whether stories should always strive to give every side equal coverage. And perhaps you've heard talk about this, like there's no need to give the opposite side of climate change. It's settled science. There's no need to have a response. Why would journalists in these cases be more likely to say that it's not a priority to get equal coverage?
Yeah, that's amazing. There's a poll that says most Americans would like their news stories to cover the different sides of a debate. And the same poll says most journalists disagree with this. They don't think that's important. And it's exactly what you say, which is that journalists have decided that they are experts. You know, this is the opposite of humility, mm-hmm. right? They've decided that they're the experts and they don't need to give equal space to untrue things, to, you know, climate skepticism. Climate change skepticism is a perfect example of that. They view this as just beyond question, or, you know, questioning the results of an election, for instance. You know, now we're increasingly seeing in the last 5 years, you know, someone makes a claim without evidence. Mm-hmm. We hear all, you know, this is now inserted into news stories all the time. So you get this sort of, you know, journalist wanting to have quote unquote expert judgment all the time, rather than just saying this is what the person said and then, you know, presenting what evidence there is, or maybe not if there isn't any, or whatever. But there's a kind of sense among a lot of journalists, I think, that they are the experts and they can now tell us the truth because, and they're going to protect us from what they view as maybe harmful ideas. And I will say at a certain level, you know, we do want a kind of expertise in journalism. I mean, we all want to rely on editors and reporters and producers who exercise judgment mm-hmm. and good judgment on what is the news. And, you know, I can't keep track of everything that's happening in the world. And I try pretty hard as the director of a journalism program. I mean, I read a lot of news every day, but I can't keep track of everything that's going on in the world. And I depend on these people in the media to make good decisions about what I should know. And then they present it and, you know, and I read some things and not others. So you do need journalists with good judgment. What you don't need are these ones who they lack humility.
Yeah.
And they say, well, there's certain things we're not even going to discuss. Or if we do discuss it, we're going to make clear that, you know, we disagree with it and think it's a horrible idea.
Talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, his essay at wordonfire.org, The News is Where You Look. We have seen one of the major newspapers in the country, the Washington Post, make some wholesale changes to the op-ed pages, but also among its reporting staff. Now, we did hear after 2016, too, media outlets trying to find and understand Trump supporters and change the tenor of coverage. That didn't really take hold. Have you seen a general shift in approach among the media?
No. I mean, there was, I think after the 2024 election, there was another round of we need to do a better job of understanding the country. In other words, you know, a kind of honest liberal saying we don't understand what's going on out there. And you saw this after 2016 and some, you know, gestures towards doing a better job of covering the rest of the country. And you know, a few efforts made in that direction, but then quickly abandoned mm-hmm. because, you know, Trump is awful or whatever. And I think there were some moments like that post 2024 as well, but I think they've essentially reverted to form. The Washington Post, though, is an interesting case, which you mentioned, which is changing its editorial perspective, which for years has been just conventional liberalism, basically a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party in all the ways you would expect a liberal newspaper to be. It was just that. It was really the sort of conventional wisdom of liberal Washington was the Washington Post's stance. Well, Jeff Bezos is the owner. He's not, you know, he didn't buy it last year. He's owned it for a number of years, but he finally is starting to exercise some of his control over the Washington Post and saying we need to change this and make the page a little more interesting. And we're going to commit ourselves to you know, the idea of freedom in every sense. And so they're reorienting the page a little bit. There have been some interesting staff changes there. Mm-hmm. We're just starting to see some of the changes. It'll be interesting to see how this shakes out in the months ahead. There'll be some controversies about departures, already have been, and hirings and et cetera. But, you know, the first signal of this was last fall when Bezos essentially spiked
right.
the Washington Post's endorsement of Kamala Harris. And he said, we're not going to endorse for president. And this caused a kind of, I don't know, staff revolt is too big of a term, but there's a lot of discomfort with that in the newsroom because they all wanted to endorse Kamala Harris. And Bezos was like, look, you know, when we endorse Kamala Harris, it confuses a lot of readers who think our news coverage is one-sided, even though very often it is. but he says it creates confusion among readers. And I think he's right about that. At any rate, they're making a lot of changes there. And I'm interested to see what happens next. I think it's going to be a better opinion section in the Washington Post.
John J. Miller leads the journalism program here at Hillsdale College, and the program emphasizes learning by doing. And journalism here at Hillsdale is a minor and not a major. So why is that, and how do students who are interested in journalism grow through the hands-on work they do here?
We're a liberal arts college. Small L liberal arts college, which means we think our students should major in traditional academic disciplines, major in history, in biology, in English, whatever. Focus your studies there. We also do journalism, and we do have some courses on journalism. It is a minor, and you can get a minor in journalism here. But the biggest emphasis we have within this journalism program is the hands-on learning, the fact that we have a campus newspaper, that we have a campus radio station, which, Scott, you and I are sitting in a studio at the campus radio station right now. And the way you learn journalism is by doing it. I can teach students some things in a classroom. I can tell them stuff, but ultimately you've got to go report stories, write articles, lay them out on a page, do all the production. It's like shooting free throws. I can describe to you how to shoot a free throw. You know, bend your knees and, you know, put your toes on the line and, you know, don't cross the line. You can say a lot of things about that, and that's even valuable information, but ultimately you gotta go shoot a bunch of free throws. And if you shoot them, you'll get pretty good at them, or at least you have a chance of getting pretty good at them. So in journalism here, we have students work on the campus newspaper. They put out a paper every week. It's a student-run publication. We have faculty advisors. We try and train them, but they're putting out a newspaper every week. And we have a radio station, which is a spoken word format. We have hours and hours of student programming every day. And it's like the applied art of rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. You want to learn how to communicate. Well, how about sitting in front of a microphone and sounding good for 10 minutes and having a monologue that is actually interesting? You know, how do you do that? It's harder than it sounds, and you know, the great ones make it sound easy, but it takes practice, it takes discernment, and that's what we teach, and you learn it by doing it.
We have graduates who are entering the world of journalism. Where have they ended up over the years, and what kind of perspectives, what kind of work have they been able to accomplish in mainstream media outlets, faith-based media outlets, or elsewhere?
We have amazing alumni in journalism, and they are everywhere. They are in the White House press pool today. We have several on the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They are at National Review, the Detroit News, the Tennessean. They are all over the place, these Hillsdale alumni, and they have different kinds of interests, these different students. They go into, some go into news, some go into opinion. There is a faith element, as you mentioned. We have alumni at First Things, which mm-hmm. is a journal of religion and public life. We have alumni at the Catholic News Agency, which is a kind of wire service that provides Catholic news, and they go into all these different kinds of places. And so a lot of diversity. You know, Hillsdale has a reputation of being a conservative school, and a lot of our students are in fact conservative, but there are a lot of flavors of that, and they come in different forms and different levels of interest in things like politics and religion, and they go into all kinds of places, and they are flourishing. And one of the things I love to say to students, and one of the things I love to say is if you're interested in a career in journalism or in the media, being a professional, if you do the minor here at Hillsdale College, you will get a job, and you'll have a shot at having a great career in that field.
John J. Miller is the director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College. You can read his essay at wordonfire.org titled "The News is Where You Look." You also now can find him writing in the Wall Street Journal in Free Expression and newsletter-focused opinion brand. You can find it at wsj.com. John, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Jonathan Butcher joins us. He's the author of The Polarization Myth. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Classical music is one of the greatest achievements of Western civilization. It took 2,000 years and the work of the greatest philosophical, scientific, political, and religious minds to properly tune the piano and make great music possible. But classical music can be intimidating. In Hillsdale College's new, free, online course, The History of Classical Music, Chopin through Gershwin, you'll learn how to appreciate humanity's greatest musical accomplishments. In The History of Classical Music, concert pianist and Hillsdale College Distinguished Fellow Hyperion Knight explains how music has developed and what distinguishes the greatest musical achievements of Western civilization. To enroll today and secure your spot in this completely free online course, visit hillsdale.edu/network. That's hillsdale.edu/network.
Great books, great people, great ideas. Learning about these things is critical to being a well-educated human being, and we can help with the Hillsdale Dialogues. Each week, Hillsdale College President Larry Arn joins radio veteran Hugh Hewitt to discuss topics of enduring relevance. And from time to time, they also talk about current events, but always with an eye toward more fundamental truths. And they want you to tune in to a conversation like no other. The Hillsdale Dialogues are posted every Monday on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. Or listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you find your audio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. We're joined by Jonathan Butcher. He's the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation, also the author of a new book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
We've heard a lot these past few months, 12 months maybe, about 80-20 issues, especially pertaining to President Trump. But reading the foreword and introduction, your idea goes back well before the beginning of this year of 2025, that there were these issues out there that people really agreed on but just didn't know it. What struck you as being unique about that?
Well, we are told over and over again by the mainstream media and by, quote, experts that America is polarized and that there's nothing that Americans can agree on. And they're making movies in Hollywood about a civil war and airstrikes being called, you know, on states around the U.S. from Washington, when in reality, Americans actually agree on quite a bit when it comes to the issues. When we talk about things like the use of, say, racial preferences in college admissions, or when we talk about teaching the idea of gender to young children, especially in grades K through three, these are things that Americans agree on, right? We don't want racial preferences. We want students to be judged based on their actions and behavior. We want young children to be protected from ideas that they're not ready for, right, that they're not mature enough to understand. And that was just a remarkable thing that our survey uncovered. And I felt like it needed to be written down so that Americans understood we actually really are speaking the same language culturally on a great many important issues.
And you point out that it's these experts that say we're polarized, or we see, yes, movies saying there's a civil war coming, or reports saying that we've never been farther apart. Should we trust the experts on this matter?
Well, I think when it comes to politics and even politicians, I mean, there's evidence from voting that there's some polarization still, but that doesn't mean that in the daily life that we each lead, right? Going off to work, sending our kids to school, watching the news and how we interpret the world around us. There's actually quite a bit of agreement that we don't want boys participating in girls' sports, for example. We have a majority who doesn't want boys to have access to girls' private spaces, right? I mean, these are things that Americans in our daily lives, we all actually agree on. And that matters because as we participate in community life, as we have policymakers looking to create constituencies to make very sound public policies, they can rest these ideas on this polling, right, on this perception. Now, there's no single survey that can answer every question or that is representative, right? They're a snapshot in time. But in my book, I found over and over again supporting surveys that found the same results that I did. I mean, over and over again, I found polling showing that parents don't like the idea that children would be taught that slavery is the most important thing in American history, right? It found that over and over again. Also found the idea that parents want character and virtue taught in schools, right? They want schools to be preparing young people to be the kinds of adults who live responsible lives. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we find over the years and not just in one survey.
The Polarization Myth is the new book by Jonathan Butcher. Inside there are, four chapters covering various topics, five chapters, check that. And the first one starts with DEI. And there has been some efforts under the Trump administration to eliminate DEI where possible, but it seems to have its fingers stuck very hard into universities and colleges across the country. Why are college officials going to such great lengths to defend DEI, to defend racial preferences in admissions, when, again, polling, and the polling's all over the polarization myth, would say the public doesn't agree with any of that?
Well, and it's not just academia. It's also in the business world. I mean, you have employees being forced to undergo trainings that tell them that they are guilty of some sort of collective guilt or collective oppression just based on the color of their skin. I had the chance to interview a scientist, a chemist at Chevron Phillips, who had to do a DEI training program. And, you know, he said, look, I don't understand why you're telling me that, you know, George Washington's teeth may have come from slaves. I'm trying to create plastics here, right? Out of using oil, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this is not helping me for my job. And it's also making me feel highly uncomfortable with the idea that I should think America is irreparably burdened by this idea of racial oppression. So that was a fascinating interview, and there are many, many others like it that you can find in the business sector around the world, around the country. And the same is true in higher education, perhaps even more so. I think some of the more interesting stories that I included in that chapter are from individuals who were DEI trainers themselves, their job was to conduct these programs on college campuses, and they themselves were canceled because in one case there's a community college professor in California who dared to say that a diversity of ideas is actually an important thing and lost her job because of it. So I think even those who push the DEI agenda have started to see that it's even more narrow than they once thought it was.
Something I thought is interesting, you mentioned it, and I think there's even another study or survey from University of Michigan, too, that students, even with these DEI programs on campuses, don't necessarily feel more safe, don't necessarily feel more accepted on campus. So what's the end result we get from this?
Well, they often put on their websites that they're trying to foster tolerance, or they're trying to create acceptance of people from different backgrounds. And really what they've done is they've made people highly insecure about who they are, and very divisive over protecting turf when it comes to ethnicity and race. It has not fostered a culture of civility. And as we can see over the last 2 years, really since the tragedy of October 7th, you know, we can really see that they haven't stopped anti-Semitism. I mean, mm-hmm. on campuses like Columbia and Harvard and in California, UCLA, and others, there have been, violence and unrest. Jewish students have not felt safe. They've been chased off of campus. I mean, this hasn't been prevented by DEI offices. So what was their purpose in the first place, right? When it really mattered, right? When protecting students really mattered and defending civil rights really mattered, these offices were nowhere to be seen.
The second chapter in the polarization myth is on COVID, student achievement, the reading wars. I love all the surveys, all the numbers in here. I was perhaps most surprised by seeing that 52% of parents are satisfied with K-12 education in the country. That seems high considering the number of problems we see in schools all across the country, particularly in K-12 education. Were you surprised by that number?
I was, and it is true, though, that the approval rates have been going down, especially coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, there are kind of two questions here. One is, do you approve of public schooling in the United States? And I think those numbers are low and have been on a downward trend for several years. And then there's the question of, are you happy with your child's education at a local school? And parents often say yes. And so I think what we find is that parents tend to be satisfied with the school that they have chosen. And there's probably some selection bias, right, that helps to explain that, right? If you've either made the choice or if you've made some sort of commitment to where you send your child to school, you probably have a little bit of bias towards that institution. And that's something that we found across surveys as well, for many years. So to help explain this, I think what we need to see is that about 2 million kids are nowhere to be found on public school rolls coming out of the COVID pandemic. We still have kids who simply just didn't go back to school or that we can't have no record of. So that's a problem. And we also have seen public school enrollment decline by about 2.5% coming out of the pandemic. And so more and more today, parents are making choices about how and where their children learn, whether that's through a private school scholarship or homeschooling or a learning pod or something like that. It's reshaping the whole landscape. And that is truly, truly notable.
There's been recent discussion about the Mississippi miracle and the improvements in K-12 education in that state. It's also referenced inside the polarization myth. What's Mississippi doing? Is it repeatable elsewhere?
Yeah, they've really invested in improving reading instruction, especially by changing how it's taught. And, you know, there was a terrific podcast that has made the rounds in the last 5-7 years called Sold a Story that talks about how American schools had been using cueing or the whole language method of teaching reading, which is it's really a part of the progressive movement that dates back more than 100 years. And we've just found that this is really to blame for the very low reading scores, reading proficiency across the U.S. Now, today, we have across states, increasingly state lawmakers are demanding that educators use what has really become known as, quote, the science of reading. And it's not phonics only, right? It's not phonics on its own, but it does reintroduce the teaching of phonics into the classroom. And that's what had been missing, right? The cueing and whole language methods had been taught at the exclusion of phonics. And I think that that is a big change that Mississippi helped introduce. Louisiana is another state that has been doing that. And my book talks about other states where lawmakers are saying, hey, this is important now that we really change the way in which we teach reading for the next step. And the next step is to be able to teach other subjects in a rigorous way, right? Civics, history, all, you know, those subjects are really what we need to help students become participating members in society.
Jonathan Butcher with us. The book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. One of those other subjects is civics, in fact, the next chapter in the book. And I was unaware of this term until maybe a year ago when I interviewed someone about the idea of action civics and how the Obama-era Department of Education, Artie Duncan, began in inserting action civics into schools across the country. What is that concept, and why isn't it doing a good job of teaching our school children about civics?
Right. Well, it's not just what they've introduced, it's what they've removed. I think that they've removed a teaching of dates and facts and figures and information about our founding fathers, significant individuals from America's past, and they've replaced it with the encouragement that students use a issue that they are very interested in and become politically active. So lobbying a lawmaker for, you know, not using plastic bags in the grocery store, for example, or holding a walkout that is condoned by the school faculty and leadership to protest gun rights, right? These are they sort of skip the part where we teach students about why there are differing views on these topics and what actually is an appropriate way to consider, right, highly charged political topics. Let's just skip to the end. Let's just tell them how to become lobbyists and how to become activists without giving them the ability and the tools and the history, frankly, to be able to determine how to understand these difficult topics. And without that basis, without that grounding, students, you know, they're applying more emotion than they are actually thinking critically about why there is such a debate on these questions.
See, Americans want, the polling says Americans want civics to work for the betterment of their children. What kind of things do parents tell us they want to see inside civics class?
Well, it's interesting. When you look back at civics textbooks from 100 years ago, I think it's not uncommon. It's actually quite common, I found, in civics books to find ideas of responsibility, of virtue, of courage, of responsibility for your actions, the idea that teachers are their best lessons are their personal example, how they live their lives, right? These are the things that are at the heart of civic behavior and civic activities, right? We should be teaching young people that it matters the way they treat other people, right? It matters how they pay attention to the way they act, the way that they complete their coursework, the way that they are engaged in community life, right? It is an issue of personal responsibility that matters. And I think that's being lost today. And instead you have, as you were saying, this action civics idea that we all need to be lobbying lawmakers for some sort of pet cause. And I think that's the wrong lesson. I mean, parents want, again, our survey found in others that I've either done myself or seen, parents want virtue and character taught to young people.
Jonathan Butcher with us. His book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. There's a section, well, actually multiple sections have questions where you break it down between general public, parents of students, and then school board members. And the sex v. gender chapter, the difference is never more stark than there, I think, where the school board members, according to the poll, want graphic sexual acts in books, 36%, compared to 13% of the general population. Why are the school board members so skewed when compared to the rest of the country?
Yeah, our school board survey is not nationally representative. It's a little heavier on the Southeast, but I included those results to give people a sense of what those who are, you know, serving on district boards are thinking. And I think the comparison is instructive because these are the people who are making decisions about what is on school library shelves. And I think that the results found that parents and the general public do not like the idea that young children would have access to explicit content on school library shelves. And there's a lot of discussion today that any attempt to remove such books from school libraries is an effort at censorship, or that you are banning books. And I think that's nonsense. I mean, I think the reality is that it is the responsibility of adults to determine age-appropriate material, right? That's the job of school board members and parents and educators. And one of our survey questions found that when we asked people who should be making these decisions, the highest response was to a combination of parents and school leaders. So I don't think that the general public is saying we should remove the authority from educators to make these decisions, but at the same time, we should include parents because they do, in fact, know their children, and they do have interests in what their children are being taught and how what values are being passed on to them. So I think that this increasingly around the country, especially over the last 18 months, I would say, we have seen evidence of states that have taken steps to either include parents in the decision making about what books are used, or otherwise take material that has no place in schools off the shelves. And that's not banning it. It just means it's not age appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, in the Out of Touch Teachers Union chapter, you say, if you're not familiar with restorative justice or have yet to form an opinion, you're in good company, which is great because I've heard the phrase, but I don't fully understand what restorative justice is. Explain for our audience, and how does that tie in to the actions of teachers' unions across the country?
Especially over the last decade, there's been a lot of attention to how school discipline is handled in classrooms, whether or not students should be suspended or expelled. Those on the radical left have made the argument that there is a school-to-prison pipeline. When you suspend or expel students, that you are setting them up to wind up in jail or in prison. And what that has done is it's allowed schools to adopt policies that keep dangerous, if not just disruptive, students in classrooms, which makes it more difficult for their peers to do well in school. It also allows, you know, violent students who frankly need some sort of discipline and oversight to remain in classrooms, and it becomes a threat to their peers. Restorative justice is this idea that instead of disciplining students, you have they call it a restorative circle in some cases, where you go face to face with the person who you have wronged or who you have accused, and you somehow talk it out, have a meeting of the minds, and you resolve the situation, and then get up, shake hands, and everybody's friends again. I think it rarely works that way, and nor should it. I think if you leave out the whole discipline part mm-hmm. of the exercise, then students haven't learned anything. Restorative justice, you can trace at least part of it back to an attempt in prison populations to make restitution. The original purpose of restorative justice was to restore. If something was, you know, damaged with arson, if something was stolen, if a person was injured, the idea was that the guilty party would be a part of a restorative act to resolve what was damaged. And the way it's used in schools is simply a talk therapy that removes the discipline part. And I think that's been very, very harmful for young people.
Final question for Jonathan Butcher. His book is The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. At the end, there's a section with conclusion, recommendations, something that you spoke about earlier in the book, bring back here, is teaching the success sequence. Tell people what that is. And this is, you know, talk about not being polarized. It seems like everyone should agree on these very simple things inside the success sequence. So what's controversial about it?
So the success sequence has been in the research literature for more than 20 years. And it's the idea from social science that if a young person finishes high school, enters college or gets a job, enters the workforce, and then gets married before having a child, they are far less likely to live in poverty as an adult. And it turns out in the research that this is true. It is true that those in their 20s, if you finished high school, got a job or entered college, and got married before you had a child, you were far less likely than your peers to live in poverty. And not just live in poverty, but actually reach middle class, according to research, especially on the millennial generation. So we should, at age-appropriate levels, be teaching young people these things, right? I mean, I think it is a simple part of the process of character formation, where you can tell young people, look, it matters if you finish high school. It matters if you do well. It matters if you, when you are finished, if you enter the workforce and are prepared to take responsibility for yourself, or if you go to college. And then when you choose to get in a relationship, if you get married before having children, you do these three things, these three parts of the success sequence, you are far less likely to find yourself in poverty. It's a way to set yourself up for success, in your adult life. And, we should be teaching young people these things. There are already in, Alabama, and a couple of other states, lawmakers have considered proposals that would do this, that would require the teaching of the success sequence to young people. And I think that this is a way in which schools can begin to move away from the DEI and identity politics that has so mired school curricula and move to something that would help prepare students to be contributing members of their communities.
Jonathan Butcher is the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation and the author of the new book, The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller from here at Hillsdale College and Jonathan Butcher, author of The Polarization Myth. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you need an electrician? Call Nate with N&B Electric and Pumps. He'll take care of your needs. He's local, he's honest, and he'll beat any local competitor's price. Call Nate at 530-524-8543.
Good day. Welcome to This Week's Town Hall News Brief. I'm Phoebe Johnson, your host, to provide the latest local updates.
Former supervisor Patrick Jones filed a lawsuit seeking nearly $56 million against District Attorney Stephanie Bridget, alleging she used county employees during work hours for her 2022 campaign. Jones claims that at least half of Bridget's cases were dismissed that year, causing taxpayer harm. When the county declined to pursue legal action, Jones filed independently. Bridget denies the allegations, stating an independent investigator found no wrongdoing. She maintains the District Attorney's office operations were not impacted by campaign activities and that she neither required nor authorized staff to work on her campaign during county time. In other news, the California Energy Commission denied the Fountain Wind Project proposed for Eastern Shasta County, aligning with previous rejections by the County Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors. The wind energy project would have covered approximately 2,855 acres of private leased land in the Montgomery Creek area. 2026 Board Chair Chris Kellstrom celebrated the decision as ending the state's attempt to override local governance, crediting the Pitt River Tribe and Redding Rancheria for their leadership in opposing the project. County Executive Officer David Rickert thanked the community for nearly 10 years of united opposition. Switching gears, a multi-agency undercover operation targeting prostitution resulted in 6 arrests at a local hotel. Investigators from the Sheriff's Office, District Attorney's Office, Redding Police Department, and FBI contacted 150 individuals through known prostitution websites. Those arrested include Cody Kane, Blake Glazier, Justin McCamus, and Jason Kearney for prostitution-related offenses. Russell Garnes and Laura Henningsen face additional charges for arranging to meet a minor for sex, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and narcotics violations. All 6 suspects were booked into the county jail. On a brighter note, Santa and Mrs. Claus delivered Christmas gifts to residents at the Redding Veterans Home through the annual Adopt-A-Vet program. Community members selected wish tags from Christmas trees and purchased gifts for veterans. Resident Jack Palacios received golf shirts and stamps, expressing gratitude for community kindness and staff support. He noted that dressing well helps and feel good when family visits. Staff reported that participants lined up early to adopt veterans, with all residents receiving gifts within an hour. Every resident had presents to open, demonstrating the community's strong support. Find more local stories by Shasta Lake Town Hall at Town Hall Brief on Linktree.com. From all of us at Town Hall Brief, thanks for listening.
Hey neighbors, have you ever wondered where you can find a store that truly feels like home? Well, look no further. Grange Co-op has been community-focused since 1934, and guess what? We're not just a store. We're owned by customers just like you. Yep, that's right. It's all about community here. So why choose Grange Co-op? When you shop with us, you're not just supporting a store, you're supporting a community. Grange Co-op has what you need for your home, garden, pets, and farm. Grange Co-op, where the values of yesterday meet the needs of today.
Hi, this is Carrie Grawl. This season marks a new chapter for Organic Pilates, a rebirth of sorts in a new, larger downtown space. Alongside it, we want to introduce you to Harmony, a lifestyle boutique created as a natural extension of how we move and live with intention. We want to invite you in. Harmony and Organic Pilates, now open in downtown Reading. We're located at 1264 California Street in between Curated and Theory Coffee. We can't wait to see you.
Good day. Welcome to this week's Town Hall News Brief. I'm Phoebe Johnson, your host, to provide the latest local updates. Chris Kellstrom will serve as the new Shasta County Board of Supervisors chair in 2026, with Corky Harmon as vice chair. Both appointments passed on 3-2 votes during Tuesday's meeting. Current chair Kevin Cry disclosed he has been diagnosed with a tumor and is awaiting further tests to determine if it's cancerous or benign. Cry, age 49, encouraged other men to seek medical screenings and expressed confidence in his recovery. The board also certified November's special election and voted to reconsider support for the True North Behavioral Health Campus project. In another development, Shasta County filed an appeal on December 5th challenging a Superior Court ruling that voided an intergovernmental agreement with Redding Rancheria. The court had found the agreement invalid following an April bench trial. County officials maintain the Board of Supervisors legally entered into the agreement. Redding Rancheria's Attorney General expressed strong support for the appeal, calling the agreement fair, reasonable, and beneficial for both tribal citizens and the broader community while supporting public safety and infrastructure needs. Moving to law enforcement news, a wanted felon from Corning led officers on a high-speed pursuit Thursday afternoon before abandoning his stolen Nissan pickup truck and fleeing on foot. Agustin Corona, 27, jumped into the Sacramento River attempting to escape but was arrested near Turtle Bay East open space after swimming across. His passenger, Aaliyah Hethcote, was caught along the riverbank. California Highway Patrol's helicopter assisted in locating both suspects. Officers found methamphetamine and numerous stolen identification cards inside the vehicle. Corona had outstanding warrants from Alameda and Tehama counties. On a positive note, a coalition of healthcare
professionals, educators, and community leaders has formed to address the physician shortage crisis affecting 17 Northern California rural counties. The Rural Northern California Medical Education Consortium aims to establish a medical school between Sacramento and Portland. The region faces critical shortages, with Shasta County's death rates 53% higher than state averages. Leaders from Simpson University, Mercy Medical Center, Shasta Health and Human Services, and medical associations are collaborating on this initiative, requiring $30 to $50 million in startup funding through federal and state grants. Find more local stories by Shasta Lake Town Hall at Town Hall Brief on Linktree.com. From all of us at Town Hall Brief, thanks for listening.
Dina's Cabinet, the local pros who know.
Mandina's Cabinets in Anderson designs custom kitchens, bathrooms, and offices that no big box store can match. They are the local pros who know.
Mandina's Cabinet. The local pros who know. Mandina's Cabinet. The local pros who know.
530-365-8108 or visit mandinascabinets.com.
Hi, this is Carrie Grawl. From the heart behind Organic Pilates, I want to introduce you to Harmony, a lifestyle boutique created for intentional living. We offer apparel, wellness, and everyday pieces designed to support how you move and how you live. Harmony, where movement meets intention. We're located at 1264 California Street. We're in between Curated and Theory Coffee. We can't wait to welcome you in.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center. The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
Bottom of it. And you can actually